Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt podcast presented by Cooper Tires, our week in IndyCar episode. So happy to have my friend Brian Herta back. How are you, my man, with Iowa IndyCar and Indy Lights on the horizon?
Yeah, I'm doing good. Thank you, Marshall. How about you?
Well, I'm okay. Bit of a sad day. I know for you as part of the Andretti Autosport family with your Brian Herta Autosport team. And I think for any of those who know and love Mario or Michael or Marco, or so many members of the Andretti family, the matriarch of the family, Deanne Andretti, died today. And this is coming after suffering a pretty big heart attack earlier in June. And you never want to say these things aren't unexpected, but I know that there had been a lot of prayers exchanged and shared within the family and outside the family, hoping that Mrs. Andretti would pull through. But what comes to mind when you think about this lady who not only has brought the world, supported Mario throughout his career, but also your partner in Michael, your driver in Marco. I have to believe that she's definitely on your mind as well.
Well, of course, it's a shame, and being close to the family and knowing how close the Andretti family is, it's a sad time because she was certainly the glue that was bonding all of them together in a lot of ways, and you can't do anything. You just want to offer support and condolence and love, and luckily the racing community has been so gracious with that on so many occasions, and this one being no different. I think it's heartwarming for all of them to hear the love from the racing community and people who feel their loss with them and are standing beside them right now at a really difficult time for the entire Andretti family.
I mentioned a little bit of this in last week's Week in IndyCar episode, Brian, when we were at Road America. Robin and I saw Mario early Friday and both just gave him a hug and gave him some love. And this, Mrs. Andretti's health issues is something that everyone had, thankfully kept private. The one thing that really impressed me, and I don't know, man, these things shouldn't be items that impress you after all these years, but maybe it's just reaffirmation. Mario, headed to Road America with not only obligations to fill with sponsors, to be there for a dinner that was put on in his honor by the track, President George Brugenthies. Mario knew that the racing world needed him as well, and with his wife in intensive care, with an extremely heavy heart, decided that, I still need to go where I am needed as well, and with the rest of the family still looking after her as much as possible. Mario came out, put on as big of a smile as possible, and if you didn't know, Brian, that he was going through, very heavy times, you wouldn't have necessarily seen it, or the outside world might not have picked up on it, just because, the man is a true professional and was able to juggle very, very hard times with his dear wife, also with having to be someone who, looks after the family with his own, obligations as well. So I guess at a time where most of us would say, to heck with work, to heck with racing, I'm shutting out the outside world, Mario was still able to come through for those who needed him in the sport, and then returned home immediately to be with Mrs. Andretti. So just again, full respect to the great man himself at a very hard time for he and his family.
Yeah, there aren't really enough superlatives to heap onto Mario. The quality of who he was as a driver, who he is as a person, and what he still means to the sport is, there isn't another contemporary that you could really put in his category in any of those categories. So, it was tough because, he was there and he was doing everything he was asked to do and all of his obligations, like you said, but it was just, he didn't have his energy I mean, that's what I noticed. And you know, normally it you know, at I think 79 years of age, you know, he's got energy that puts me and most of us around him to shame. And that was missing. And you know, certainly we understand why. And you know, I think it was good for him to be with his racing family too, as he was, you know, coping with the struggles that Deanne was having.
Well, before we get to talking about what's coming up at Iowa in what is admittedly a relatively light week for big IndyCar news, more than happy to mention that one of the first brands I ever came in contact with, Brian, when I was a young first-time racing mechanic at 16 years old, working with the team run by Mike McHugh, Bad Company, Bay Area Distributing Company, his SCCA Pro Super V team. The Justice Brothers were a big sponsor of the first team I ever worked on, and I certainly carted around countless boxes of JB product. And then in 1998, in my second Indy 500, when I was the assistant engineer and assistant team manager for the General Racing Thomas Knapp team, we had all of our sponsorship collapse days before the start of practice for the 98 Indy 500. And through some reaching out to contacts that I had and others that came in, Ed Justice Jr. and the Justice Brothers family came on board as a sponsor there as well. So been a brand that I've had a very personal association with for actually my entire racing career, and really, really happy to say that they've come on board this month as a sponsor of the Marshall Pro podcast. So their additives, lubricants, cleaners, definitely a quality brand that I think many of us are familiar with in motor racing, in Gasoline Alley, whatever shops we might be. The products are used and improved by the world's top racing teams. And the cool thing that they've asked me to do, Brian, is rather than just, you know, do ads in each podcast talking about how awesome they are, they're hoping to and looking to recruit more people to be part of their family to sell their products. So this little item here talking about how Justice Brother does offer products for the automotive, semi-truck, agricultural, and industrial markets. This is something that they would like to grow their sales and distribution network. And so they do have opportunities that folks can check out at justicebrothers.com. So with that said, and with welcoming Justice Brothers to the Marshall Pro Podcast for the month of July, let's talk about what's coming up here at Iowa, Brian. This certain team you happen to be affiliated with, you guys are quick like a bunny at the recent Iowa test. What's different about that place with this new aero specification that you think might make the racing either more interesting or just vastly different than what folks might have seen in recent years with high downforce?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We tested there about a week ago, I think exactly a week ago, with a number of cars and teams. And, you know, surprisingly, when we did some long runs and some group running later in the day, and surprisingly, a lot of guys took to the second lane, which is something we didn't really see last year. And even some of the cars on our team and other teams seem to prefer the first lane. Some seem to prefer the second lane. So I can't really say exactly what the formula is, but you know, this new car has been racing really well everywhere we go. And for me, Iowa was probably one of the big question marks because it's a lot less downforce there than we've had in the past. But based on what I saw at the test, I'm really optimistic that it's gonna race well there. It's gonna be exciting racing, and you know, Iowa's always pretty tense with the high banks and the short oval nature of the races there. So I'm kind of looking forward to this this weekend and seeing how it all plays out.
A little bit of a unexpected question to ask on this topic, and unfortunate as well. But you know, in the sport, we are not unfamiliar with or untouched by loss, the sense of having to dig down and still operate at either your peak or as close to your peak as possible is something that, again, many of us have had to do, whether it's driving a car, turning a wrench, engineering, etc. You have a driver in your entry in Marco Andretti who just lost his grandmother. Again, we've already stated how important and how big of a role she played in the family. Any thoughts on how you might go into this weekend, trying to not push too hard, but also trying to keep Marco's, you know, emotions up, if that is indeed what he needs?
We'll see. I haven't spoken to Marco today, and probably speak to him in the next couple of days. But I don't anticipate there being a lot of crossover there. In some ways, just having been out there myself and knowing, sometimes the best thing you can do is put that helmet on and get in that race car, because it takes you to a different place. It puts you in a different mindset, and you know, you hear different drivers describe it as being in the zone or something. And you know, I can give you countless examples of times when, you know, I was hurt or sick, and you get in that car and those things kind of go away, or whatever else is going on in the world or in your life, in a certain way, it demands you to get singularly focused on the job at hand. And, you know, that can be cathartic, especially, you know, for somebody who's done it a long time. So, you know, Andretti's are racers, and racing is what they do. And I know that Marco will have a heavy heart, but I also know he's going to show up ready to race this weekend in the Iowa Corn 300 and do the best job he possibly can. So I don't really have any concerns there, really, just, you know, more out of the car, providing as much, you know, condolence and support as we can, but also staying focused on moving forward and trying to win that race.
Last question before we get into a bunch of questions, and I don't want to delve in too deep here because we do have a lot of great questions on this subject. Indy Lights. So you're going to be there trying to win the race with Marco, the IndyCar portion. Your son Colton also on the Indy Lights side. Boy, he's been kicking butt and taking names of late, has a good lead in the championship, but not one that you can necessarily just rest on and cruise. What's that coaching session like, or, you know, what is that dynamic like between you and mini Herta Mania, knowing that, you know, the entire Herta family is going to Iowa with pretty clear objectives? Do you get in there with your son pretty heavily on how to approach this and hold on to this championship lead, or is he taking more of a leadership role in how he approaches his weekends?
Yeah, not really too much. You know, He's in the zone right now. He's driving really well. Things are going his way. He's got good momentum. And, you know, so really just kind of letting him be and letting him do his thing. He certainly understands what he's got to try and do, you know, not just in Iowa, but for the rest of the season. Like you said, he's in the points lead, which is a good position, but it's not a lead that you can take for granted. So, you know, I've really been appreciative of Michael this year. You know, there's been a couple times when, you know, Colton's needed some guidance on some things, and Michael came to me and said, you know, hey, I think, you know, I want to go tell Colton this, or, you know, what do you think if I tell him that? And obviously, Colton's my son, so coming from Michael Andretti, any kind of feedback becomes a lot more meaningful
sure,
at times.
Sure.
And so he's pulled Colton aside a couple times and said, you know, hey, I noticed this, or, you know, I think you can work on this. And, you know, he's responded really well to that. So, you know, I get more credit than I should for coaching him, because I don't do very much of it. And, you know, I love when he calls or texts me and says, hey, you know, can we meet at hospitality? I want to talk to you about something. And that's really where I try to be is he's got great people around him with his engineers and team manager. I just try and be that other piece of the puzzle when he wants to talk to somebody else or just bounce somebody off. Something off somebody, then I try not to spell somebody something. I try and be there for him for those kinds of things.
Now, what would be really awesome if he texted you and said, "Hey, could you meet me at hospitality?" When you got there, he said, "So I'd like a grande latte with not too much foam." At which point, you'd smack him in the head, of course. But you know,
he's still my kid, so yeah, that wouldn't fly.
Well, before we jump into our favorite part, listener questions, we pick my favorite question from the previous episode, and offer that kind person either a Marshall Pruitt Podcast t-shirt or mug. And looking back at last week's with our guest Anders Krohn, who I think is just killing it as a new member of the IndyCar radio team this year, I'm going to pick Paul Davis, who his question, we've been going with fun ones lately, but I thought this one brought up a good conversation about, he said, I'd like to hear your thoughts on teams and broadcasters, knowing how much push to pass the other drivers have and when drivers are using it. And he brought up the example of Mid-Ohio last year. Tim Cindric was coaching Joseph Newgarden on when Hunter Ray was using his push to pass. And he said he believed that push to pass info should be kept by the teams and not shared. So I just thought that that brought up an interesting conversation there, Paul. So shoot me a note on Facebook whether you would like a large or extra large or maybe a medium if we have any t-shirts left, or a mug, and then we'll get your shipping information sorted out. And our friends at Toronto Motorsports, the ones who kindly put these t-shirts together, and we've got another wave, a second generation of Marshall Pruitt Podcast specific Week in IndyCar t-shirts that are hopefully not more than a couple weeks away from being done, but our good friends at TorontoMotorsports.com are the ones that look after us here and send them out each week to winners. So send in your info, Paul, and TorontoMotorsports.com will get you sorted. And I also know that they are working heavily on a rather amazing display for the Toronto IndyCar race coming up here in about a week and a half. So we'll talk more about that next week and get you tuned up for all they have going there. But I know that there's a lot of cool stuff that Derek Koska and his team are preparing for IndyCar fans. All right, Brian, we have, again, we've got a bunch of great questions here. Other thing that might be worth noting is from the last time you were on, and I probably should have looked back and seen exactly how long it was, but from the last time you were a guest here in the Week in IndyCar, Brian, we've had a lot of folks ask nearly identical questions of you. So I don't take that as a bad thing. I take that as hopefully we have some, you know, newer audience members who are getting a chance to reach out for the first time. So while I might not ask every single one of the story, you know, of folks asking you about the pass at the Corkscrew in 1996 or for certain stories from when you drove for this team or that team, because we do have, you know, a lot of similar questions that have been asked, I'll try and pick one. So appreciate your bearing with us, but I know you're one of many who's always looking to try and engage new fans. So good on you. Let's see. This one comes in from Kevin Perez Frederico, who asks great questions each week. It says, Brian, you seem to get Marco's confidence back up from his recent qualifying and race results. What do you feel is still missing? He says, do you think you guys can be top dog at Iowa among the Andretti Autosport entries? So how's that going in terms of keeping Marco in a positive place, maybe more positive than we've seen from him in many years? And do you think, even despite family sadness this week, that, you know, he's still locked into a pretty good place?
Well, you know, first off, I really need to say most of the credit for, you know, Marco's improved form lies with Marco. You know, he's put a lot of work in the last year and over the winter to, you know, change some things, change some of his approach, and I think that's paying off. And you know, I think we're happy to see it, and I'm supporting that. But, you know, in the car evolution has changed. You know, we got away from these really, really super high downforce packages, and you know, the current aero kit, I think, suits his driving style a little bit more. But it's a lot more than just that. It's a lot of little things. And, yeah, I like the trajectory that we've been on. You know, we've continued to get better. We've, you know, Detroit was a great weekend for us, and frankly, he should have been on the podium on Sunday, but for his bonehead strategist tried to put him on a two-stop plan when he really needed to be on a three-stopper. but frankly, he drove great there, and then we went to Texas, and he was doing outstanding there, and we'd just driven up in the fourth, and he was one of the fastest cars, and we had a clutch issue that, you know, we lost a couple laps in the pits, and so it kind of ruined our race there. So there's a lot of things like that we see that are going really well. We had a great test at Iowa, and it's just a process, you know, and it's you need 100 little things all to be right to win. You know, you got to have great pit stops, you got to have great in and out laps, you got to have good qualifying position, you got to have good track position. All all these things. And what I like is we've checked all those boxes now, but we haven't checked them all on the same weekend yet. So that's what we're working on now is, you know, the qualifying pace is there, the race pace is there, the pit stops are there, all the things that we've kind of been rebuilding and building towards. I feel like we have everything we need to win now, but now it's putting it all together at the same time, and that's a typical challenge, and that's what we're all fighting against week in and week out, and that's no different than what Scott Dixon's trying to do or any of the other drivers out there. But I feel like we're in a position now to put up those kind of results and those kind of weekends, and I expect the second half of the year here will be, you know, even better for us than the first half has been.
It'd be amazing to see what a Marco Andretti win would do for him, for the team, I even think for the series. And it's not as if it's out of the realm of possibilities, but having witnessed, I think, his first and his last win, adding a third, I think, boy, knowing that Graham has become a threat everywhere, just about everywhere that we go, you know, something our friend Robin Miller has been preaching forever, that, man, could you imagine if these two, you know, second or third generation drivers, I should say, are, you know, really able to be always in the hunt for wins. You know, I know that Marco has plenty of detractors on the internets, but just from a health of the series and growth standpoint, man, those headlines are easy to sell to the ESPNs and pick any of the big networks that normally, you know, don't look too hard for IndyCar storylines to cover. You start putting the Andretti name up there, and along with Ray Hall and others, that's only a good thing for us. All right, let's see. Daniel Kincaid is one of many who's asked, back in the Andretti Green days with Tony Kanaan, Dario, Dan Weldon, and yourself, there must be many stories and pranks. Any chance you can share one? And part of me, Brian, thinks that you might need to actually start documenting these so you can kind of pull from them, you know, because I know you get asked a lot. All right, let me go to story number 42. I haven't told that one in a while.
Yeah, there's been a lot. I feel like they've been told and retold at various times, and they're probably even getting better as the years are going on.
Absolutely.
But, you know, essentially we had a lot of fun on the team, and I'll tell you, I think one that I probably haven't told, or I don't remember telling outside the team, was kind of a fun one. It gave you a sense of the kind of things that we did, you know. The pie in the face or the glass of water in the face was a weekly occurrence. That was kind of a normal, you know, the pie in the face gag. I guess it seems a little old-timey, but never got old for us.
Mm-hmm.
But when we were racing in Japan at Motegi, and everybody, the team members would all put all their travel gear, their team uniforms and everything, in the travel boxes that would ship with the cars on the jets over to the track, so they didn't have to carry it in their luggage. So I found out about this, and I called my buddy George Klotz, who's now the team manager over at Foyt.
Yep.
And he was the crew chief on my car at the time. And I said, hey, go grab all Rob's pants. Rob Cleveland was our PR guy, our much-loved PR guy. And I said, go grab all Rob's pants and cut all the pockets out of them and then hang them all back up. So he did that. So poor Rob Cleveland got to Japan, and first day put his pants on, and he had no pockets in them, and none of his pants there had pockets. He had no way of fixing them. So all weekend Rob was a common sight, holding his room key and his cell phone and everything in his hands because he had no way to carry them around. So, and my kids to this day still call him Pockets. That became his nickname. So that was a
Oh, that is awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it was fun. It was childish kind of, you know, type stuff, teasing kind of things. We were never mean-spirited, but we were pretty relentless with it.
No, I mean, the stories like that, if and when I ever make the time, I probably need to do just a book on motor racing pranks and mischief. I know that in my earlier junior open wheel mechanic days, I think we had one boss of ours who, I think like most of us, was fairly averse to smoking and cigarette smoke, but I mean, he just was an absolute Nazi about it, and I don't remember who, but one of our crew members basically decided he had a van. Our team owner had a van that he drove on a regular basis, and someone basically borrowed the van when he wasn't aware, and just smoked about 500 packs of cigarettes with the windows rolled up, and parked the thing, you know, without letting any of it escape, and I believe closed the vents on the AC. And yeah, when he got in, he lost it. I think there was another trip where I think we were going in two different SUVs, and this might have been the Genoa days. I think someone, whether it was some really nasty cheese or something, but stuffed some inside of one or two of the AC, the little AC grates on the dash, and let that stew for about a day before the trip. So when they got in with no other choice of what to drive, they had an entire, I think we were going to Buttonwillow, which is maybe 4 or 5 hours. So yeah, just a couple hours of rancid, cheesy nastiness. So
you spend a lot of time on the road together. You know, you're working hard, it's hot, and sometimes it's easy to get kind of a little tired of being around each other at times, so cutting up a little bit sometimes. I'll tell you, if you got time for
another
quick one, the one that I never pulled off was you know, back when we were all driving together at Andretti Green, and Honda was nice enough to give us all loaner vehicles. And Dan had an Acura RL. I think it was a silver one, or maybe it was an MDX. But anyway, I tried and tried to find a salvage yard that had an MDX that they were going to crush, and so that when Dan parked at the Speedway in his parking spot, I was going to have his car towed away and have a crushed MDX of the same model put in.
Oh, that would have been the best.
When he came out, and I'm so disappointed I never able to pull that one off. So there's one I never told the story because we didn't pull it off, but that would have been probably my favorite one if I managed it.
Well, hopefully A, Colton won't listen to this episode, and B, if he moves up into IndyCar with, you know, either Chevy or Honda, you know, there's still time. We can make this one happen. I'm confident in that. All right, let's see. So we got a couple of the prank questions there taken care of. Another question here about sharing memories about some of the team owners you've driven for. And I think in our last episode, we spoke about Chip Ganassi and Bobby Rahal. So Elliot Zentelman asks about both Foyt, Ganassi, and Rahal. Maybe let's stick with Foyt. Any either interesting stories or takeaways from your somewhat limited time of driving for Supertechs?
AJ was great. He was great to drive for, and you know, he took really good care of me. You know, he's got this fiery personality, and everybody knows him for his temper, but he's really a big teddy bear in a lot of ways. And what I loved is it was my first IndyCar ride, and I was still finding my way, and you know, I was still fairly young, not like, you know, super young, but I still had family around and things, and he just welcomed everybody into the group. And I remember he used to have a state trooper that would kind of stay with him or follow him around because he's AJ Foyt. And but he'd always go to bed early, so he'd go to his room sometimes at the Speedway Motel at, you know, 7 o'clock at night. He'd go early dinner, go to his room, and he was in for the night. So we'd go with the state trooper, and we'd go full lights and sirens down to the Cocoline and and grab sunflower seeds and Gatorade, and you know, he let us work the siren and run some red lights, and you know, we had a good time. It was a little bit of a different time then. You know, you get away with a few things that you can't anymore, but you know, when I drove for AJ, I never waited for a table in a restaurant, because if there was four of us going to dinner, every reservation was Foyt party of five, and we'd get there and say, AJ said, just see us right away, he's right behind us. And then we'd sit down and we'd inform them, oh, he just called, he's not going to make it, so we're just going to order. It was, when you drove for AJ Foyt in Indianapolis, you never had to wait for a table.
No,
so that was nice.
It's like being a member of the royal family there. Well, Brian, we have a great mix of kind of back in the day questions for you, both, you know, as a driver and such, and also some fun, you know, new or modern questions as well. So I'm going to do my best to bounce back and forth, so we're not just plucking old-timey themes or new ones. Horatio Frase is an interesting one, and I don't know, maybe you might need to answer this a little more than I do, but Horatio Frase says, Marshall, what is the relationship you and Robin have with the media? And I don't know if you mean drivers or series. He says, are you guys friends with drivers and owners, or do they tolerate you guys? He said, the feeling is that this is a genuine friendship. It's an interesting question, Horatio, because while I am a member of the media and Robin is a member of the media, we didn't start out as members of the media. We both, you know, we are lifelong racers and came into our profession from working in IndyCar, working on IndyCar teams, and I also did some sports car stuff too. So I guess the friends thing might be accurate, just because, I don't know, I've never viewed us as outsiders. If anything, sometimes I forget we are members of the media because I think we're both just doing the same job, just a different version of it, but in the same paddock with the same people and names and whatnot. But I don't know, Brian, maybe that's, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but where do media members fit in your general mindset as to, you know, either their role or where they fit in the general racing family? And are there any distinctions, or is it just one general group that's part of the overall mix?
Yeah, no, I think there's, at least for me, you know, there's always been sort of two media, you know, and there's guys like yourself and Robin, Malsher, you know, there's guys who cover our sport and have covered it for a long time, and like you know, you guys have come out of working for teams and transitioned in the media, and you live it day in and day out like we do, you care about it like we do. And you develop friendships over the years with people, you know. So I think there's certain guys like that that, like you said, it's a little different category. And then there's media that come in and cover the event, or local media or things. And I think there's a difference because there's not that familiarity, you know. And you do over time develop relationships with people. So, you know, certain guys like the two of you that cover the sport so closely and half for so long, and I think the big distinction is really care about the sport. You know, and I can't say that there isn't an occasion here or there where you're going to say something that, you know, we might not like, or vice versa. But that's okay. That's part of what your job is and what our job is. So, I mean, that's kind of how I see it.
It's funny you mention that, because that's actually the, and I'm going to dive off this topic in a moment because I don't want to make, you know, me and what I do is not really meant to be the heart of what we talk about here, but what you just mentioned is actually what I use as the divining rod of a proper relationship, and one that is either malfunctioning or just isn't proper to begin with. And that is, you know, sometimes I will have to write something that I know is going to cause stress on a working relationship, or even, you know, personally, friend to friend, but that is part of my job, or Robin, or who, you know, whomever else, and vice versa. Sometimes when, you know, I know you know something, and I ask you about it, and you know, say, sorry, no comment, or can't talk about it, or whatever, that might be frustrating on my end. But the point being is, if the relationship is correct, there's enough respect to realize that, hey, as long as you're not trying to actively harm one another, we can't always be in agreement. There are times where we can't accommodate one another's needs, but I respect that. And I think that respect of knowing that, hey, if we can all be friends, great, but there will be times where things aren't exactly perfect or super happy, but that doesn't mean that, you know, the relationship is broken down. Those who understand that, look, there'll be hopefully more positives than negatives, but if there is something negative, it doesn't mean everything collapses. Most folks, I think, grasp that. Some don't, but I would say that is essentially at least what I look for and say, okay, this is a person that I know I can work with and trust, and vice versa, even if there's a little bit of stress introduced every now and then.
Yeah, I agree.
So let's see. We got a question here from Michael Goodyear. It says, Brian, can you talk about the last few laps of the 1995 Cleveland Grand Prix. I think I was there. I love Cleveland. Apart from wishing that circuit would find its way back onto the schedule, the finish to that race and the battle between you, Michael Andretti, and Jacques Villeneuve was so exciting to watch, especially with you really demonstrating a total recovery from the injury sustained at Toronto the year before. So, among your many races, where does a late race duel at Cleveland 95 stand out?
Cleveland was one of my favorite tracks. You know, it was really fast, really bumpy, really challenging road course. You know, it seemed to suit me. I had some great runs there, and that should have been my first win. It really should have been, and I kind of blew it. I made a mistake. Story of my life. I was too nice a guy, and so it was late in the race, just a couple laps to go. And Michael was slowing, and I can't remember why. He had some kind of an issue, I think, but he was slowing, and I was catching him at a pretty good clip. And as we're coming down to the last chicane before we come on the front straight with maybe two laps to go, we got down there, and I was coming up to the chicane, and Michael had slowed, and so I pulled out. As I pulled out, I realized there was a corner worker there with a standing yellow flag out. And I don't even know what the yellow was for, but I saw that yellow. And I jumped on the brakes, trying not to pass him under yellow, thinking, oh, great, I'm going to get a penalty for passing him under yellow. And I slowed down as much as I could. And finally, he went. But in that kind of back and forth, Villeneuve had a big run. So as we came out of that chicane, he passed both of us. And then we went down into that turn one hairpin, and Michael had to go back at Villeneuve and actually hit him in the back tire. And at that point, I was right behind those guys, and I thought, oh, good, he's going to take him out and still go on to win. But Michael kind of bounced up in the air, and I drove around Michael on the outside there. But Villeneuve was able to continue on, and there wasn't enough time left for me to try and attack him again. So I ended up finishing second. It was really thrilling kind of last couple laps and exciting. But as I think back to it, the thing I remember is my mistake. You know, when I saw that yellow, I should have just realized my momentum's going to carry me past. I'm better off just going on and, you know, beg for forgiveness later. You know, but I tried to ask for permission. It didn't work out exactly right.
Got a couple of Indy Lights-related questions here from David Paquin, so I'll try and combine them as best I can. He's asking, how do the Andretti Autosport debriefs go down in Indy Lights this year? He says there's two extremely competitive championship-caliber drivers, and then you have both Dalton Kellett and Ryan Norman, who, by comparison, are, you know, not having as strong of a year. David's curious how the debriefs go down, knowing that you have two directly in the hunt for the title and the other two that aren't. And then he had another tack on saying, how I happen to write a story that Colton was garnering considerable attention from IndyCar team owners. He was wondering if Pato O'Ward's name has been tossed around at all. So I might answer the Pato part, but I think sure. We also might be assuming that because you have a son in Indy Lights, that you're just smack dab in the middle of everything Indy Lights related within Andretti Autosport.
Yeah, this is the thing that might surprise some people, but I've never sat in one of their debriefs, so I have no idea what it's like in that trailer after a session when they're all going through their data and talking about their cars. I know Colton, and you know, I know he'd have his head down, and he's talking to his engineer and probably not very worried about what anybody else is doing or saying. Just that's kind of his personality. But I don't really know how they get on. They seem to get along fine. You know, we all go have lunch together at the hospitality area and stuff, and they're all good kids. I enjoy being around all the drivers. So, you know, there's probably some inherent tension between the two that are right now in the championship battle. But I think they're both pretty confident young drivers too, so I think that they're not super threatened by each other. That tends to help. I've never even heard Colton on the radio. I've never put a headset on when he's in the car. I've never listened to it. You know, they've offered, and I said no. I don't know why, but sometimes I feel like if I hear him say something or whatever, I'm going to worry more. I'm happiest, frankly, when I know the least, because then I can just, there's less things for me to obsess or worry about when he's driving.
Well, but I love that fact, though, Brian, the fact that rather than being the stereotypical, you know, little league dad or whatever, where you're just 1,000%, turn left, brake, now, you know, instead of being in the middle of every little thing, you know, now that he's reached this stage, you're really more of a standing back and letting him grow within the Andretti organization naturally, instead of trying to manipulate, you know, the process at all times. So I actually think that's really cool. And I think it maybe also speaks to the job you and the lovely Mrs. Herta have done in raising the kid, because, you know, without you turning the screws on what he does every moment now, we've seen the kid has been, you know, really thriving. So pretty cool. Let's see. I'm trying to think what else, David, on the Pato Award front. Admittedly, I need to ask more team owners where he might be on their radar. I think he, as I've mentioned more than once, I think that kid is super talented. I don't know if he is as complete of a puzzle as Colton right now. He either seems to be incredibly awesome and dominant, or playing from behind and having to make a lot of passes and move forward. And so, you know, I would say in terms of outright speed, I haven't seen anyone in Indy Lights that is faster than Pato, but I'm not sure that I've seen that complete puzzle. Granted, we're also talking about someone who's an Indy Lights rookie. I know that he did a little bit last year, but, you know, we're not talking about a kid who's coming in his second or third year and, you know, delivering below expectations. I think, if anything, the kid is delivering far above any expectations folks might have had. So, unfortunately, Brian's son is kind of putting a lot of heat on him and others, though, to be darn near flawless. So, but I would say that, you know, I know for Pato, he said he really does need to win the championship to have that $1 million advancement prize from Mazda in order to entertain IndyCar ideas. So, you know, we've got a couple of kids who are really, really looking at that championship being a transformational thing for their future. Let me go back a little bit here. Grayson Gibson says, Brian, what's your favorite memory of Greg Moore? He said he was a favorite of mine growing up watching you guys in kart, and he always seemed like he must have been a blast to be around. We lost him far, far too soon.
Yeah, you know, Greg, it's a tricky one, and, you know, I think just his heart and passion and the way he drove, especially on ovals. I mean, he was something else. He came in as a rookie and put on some drives on some ovals. I remember, I think his first race at Homestead was, you know, he was right up near the front and really shocked a lot of people. You know, and he obviously had a great personality. He was well liked within the paddock. He had many, many friends amongst the drivers, you know, which made his passing even harder, because there's many guys, especially, you know, guys like Dario and Tony and Max Pappas and Christian Dumas that were, you know, in that group that were very, very close with Greg. And he was just that kind of guy, you know, if you were having a party, he was definitely going to be on the list of people to invite.
Yeah, and I've mentioned maybe once or twice on previous podcasts whenever Greg has come up. I was fortunate to get to know him a little bit when he and his father Rick came down from Western Canada to the West Coast here in California and ran in some of the Western states Formula Ford 2000 Pro Series. And so, having known him, I guess, a little bit there, and then more as he moved up into Indy Lights, and then seeing him in IndyCar, I can tell you, the kid who showed up and was just a beast in Formula Ford 2000s, I didn't see a lick of difference between Greg Moore, the person at that very early stage in his career, Brian, to the guy who turned up an IndyCar and was looking like a future champion there. And that, I think, is, in that era in particular, where there were so many superstars still participating, you know, whether it was a Michael Andretti, an Alan Sir Jr., yourself, Bobby Rahal was there. I mean, we can go on and on and on. There were so many stars, Vassar, Zanardi, so on and so forth. There were a lot of drivers who, I'm not saying they were aloof, but I'm saying that they were regarded as, you know, very prized athletes. And there might have been a layer of separation between those superstars and the fans. Again, just from the good fortune and coincidence of getting to meet him for the first time, you know, when he was first in the sport, I didn't see any of that in him. And that's one of the things that I, A, respected, and also, B, I think that's why so many folks really connected with him, Brian, is, you know, in and among many of these superstars, he was there driving, winning, being successful, but was just as humble as your next door neighbor.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, we got a couple of Colton-related questions. Actually, I'm lying when I say a couple. We got a whole bunch of Colton-related questions. So let me see what I can do to condense some of these. It's your fault, man.
Think it's telling that you're getting more questions about Colton than you are about me.
You need to get back in the saddle and do something, old man. Come on, this kid's showing you up here.
There's going to be. I'll hint at something. I'm going to be coming out of retirement for something at the end of the year. I'm not really I never really retired. But Colt and I are going to be doing a race together towards the end of the year. That's going to be announced in the coming weeks. It's going to be fun and exciting and something we've never done before.
Oh, well, I love that. And we've got a question here that might, I don't know if it's that specifically, but, all right. So we've got a question here from Keith Lee. And again, Keith, trying to manage the questions here a little bit, knowing that, while Brian is certainly the father of Colton, we've learned that he is not the architect pulling the strings going, woo-ha-ha-ha, this is how your future will play out, kid. Keith says, what would be the ideal situation for Colton next year? And do you have a preference in which team you would like him to drive for?
Oh, that's interesting. So, you know, if I were to say what does next year a perfect scenario look like, obviously Colt needs to continue doing what he's doing this year. And that's, you know, if I do tell him anything, it's that. Keep your head down, focus on the next race and then the next one, and don't look too far ahead, because if you focus on the races now, what's next will take care of itself. I don't know how, but it you know, how it'll play out, but something good will happen. But, you know, ideally he's gonna find a home with a current team. He's gonna be able to have at least one good, experienced teammate that he can learn off of and feed off of, and also kind of benchmark himself off of, and a team that's hopefully looking to invest in the future and have a driver that, you know, if they can put a couple of years into, can hopefully develop into somebody that can be, you know, not just a race winner, but hopefully a championship caliber guy in the future. So that's what I hope for, is that kind of an opportunity.
We've got a couple on this theme.
But it doesn't necessarily have to be where I am. And there's a lot of reasons for me to say that I don't think it should be. I think he and I are both better off if he's racing somewhere else. I think he 100% shares that view. And it's not because we don't think we could work together. It's frankly because I think he can focus better on himself and what he's doing without, you know, if I'm there, there's just a natural gravity towards it, and vice versa, that doesn't exist if we're on different teams. And I want him to develop as he's continued to do. I mean, I'm really proud of what he's doing, but he's doing his racing himself, you know, and I give him advice as a father when I can, but I'm certainly not micromanaging his career, and, you know, that's working for us, and that's going to continue to be how we operate.
And so this question from Jeff Barak, it's an interesting one. It's one I've thought of, and I'm sure you've thought of. He said, having seen Marco Andretti and Graham Rahal drive for teams operated by their fathers, what would your thoughts be in Colton driving for your team? Something to avoid or something you'd embrace? And I'll maybe add to that, Brian, in that, you know, we have seen there can be a stigma attached, right? son spends too long driving for his father, and maybe there becomes that stigma of, ooh, well, if it wasn't for your old man, you know, maybe you don't have the talent to get hired by a pick the name Roger Penske or someone else. And hey, if this kid's just, you know, stuck with driving for their old man, then, you know, how good can they really be? Is that anything that, I mean, I know that that isn't the case with Colton, but I mean, does that kind of stigma pop in your mind at all with a question like that?
No, not as much. I mean, I think, you know, what I just said before was more to do with it.
Okay.
You know, I would never say that in the future we could work together, or, you know, and maybe at a certain point when he's established himself and, you know, the stars align, that could happen. I think that'd be cool in a lot of ways, but, you know, like I see what Graham did, and he went off and drove for some other teams. He now drives for Bob's team. And I think that's really cool. I obviously work with Marco, who drives within Michael's team. And there is, at times, a stigma attached to that. But the reality is different than, you know, the perception. You know, certainly, I think people can see, you know, Marco doesn't get preferential treatment. Cars, you know, Rossi, Hunter Ray, Veach, they all have the same opportunities he does. So, you know, certain doors open, but it comes with a lot of scrutiny, and there's two sides to that that particular scenario. So, you know, like I said, for Colton, I think he and I feel like if he can find an opportunity within another team, that's the best thing for him.
Amen to that. We've got a couple other questions here about driving preparedness and such related to Colton. So maybe let me pick one here, and then we'll move. We'll try not to turn this into the Colton Herta Memorial Week in IndyCar episode. Not that we don't enjoy talking about your kid. I mean, he's a delight. Let's see. Ben Cohen says, Brian, what do you think is the next attribute Colton needs to add to his racing toolbox in order to make the jump from Indy Lights to IndyCar?
Oh, good question. You know, I'm going to say it's just a greater depth of experience, and especially on the technical side. You know, that'll be the next challenge for him moving from Indy Lights to Indy Cars. There's so much more adjustability in the cars. There's so many more variables with aero configurations and tire, you know, two different types of tires on road courses and engine settings, and working with a team of engineers and a shock development engineer, all the tools that you have, all the resources you have at your fingertips when you're an IndyCar driver that you don't have in Indy Lights. And that's really the next toughest thing. The driving of the car, frankly, is no harder. It's a faster car,
yeah,
and it's more physical, but I don't believe it's any harder to go fast in an IndyCar than it is an Indy Lights car. But it's corralling all these extra resources around you and understanding how to utilize them and how to use them to make your car better and do all that. That'll be the next challenge for him, or any driver, frankly, moving up out of Indy Lights into IndyCar that has to face.
I'm going to throw in here, we'll take a quick little pause. Please, if you can, check out our friends at TorontoMotorsports.com, the good folks who make the Marshall Pruitt Podcast t-shirts and a variety of awesome stickers. I'm guessing there's either going to be a Herta Mania Junior sticker coming up here pretty soon from them. And also to mention again our friends of the Justice Brothers with their additive lubricants and cleaners have become America's brand for quality. And those products are used and proven by the world's top racing teams. And on the sales and distribution front, they do offer products for automotive, semi-truck, agricultural, and industrial market. So if you would be interested in joining that lovely family there from a sales standpoint, you can check out their website at justicebrothers.com. All right, well, we're going to start to wind down the old episode here, Brian, so I'm going to be a little more picky and choosy on questions to get us to the finish line here. Let's see. Chris G., has a question here related to, I think I'm looking a couple years ahead, Brian, about when we are looking forward to more horsepower coming from the new IndyCar regulations. Chris G says, you were a standout during the era of huge speeds at places like California Speedway and the ill-fated kart race at Texas. He says, what was that experience like when you go to a place like Texas and immediately saw monster speeds and the medical side effects of that? He says, might that give newer fans some insight into how bigger speeds aren't always a good idea?
Well, that's a great question. And yeah, I'm curious to learn more about, you know, the future plan, because I know fans and of IndyCar, a lot of people have been clamoring for 1,000 horsepower cars and lower downforce. But I'm also trying to remind people we did that. We did 1,000 horsepower cars and really low downforce in kart in the late 90s. And the problem or the challenge it creates is the cars are just monsters and they're phenomenal to drive on the road and street courses. I mean, they're just perfect. They're so challenging and exciting, and you can fourth gear wheel spin, and you know, you don't even want to think about driving in the rain. Pretty crazy. And it, all those things, it's amazing. But then on the ovals, the cars become too fast, and it becomes harder and harder to slow them down, and you have to start creating more and more artificial ways, and you keep taking downforce off, as we did. I mean, if you recall, we were racing on short ovals with speedway wings towards the end of that era, and then the unloved, much unloved Hanford device, which created a 20-mile-an-hour draft behind cars. And even with those types of things, you know, we were going, you know, 240, 250 miles an hour on the 2-mile ovals on the straightaways. So, you know, I think that's the big thing that IndyCar is, and they have time right now to plan out these things, is how are you going to rectify these two things? How are you going to make the cars these amazing 1,000 horsepower boost beasts on the street course and road courses, and not make them so fast that you almost, you know, we literally got to the point, and Texas was right at the zenith of that, where we almost couldn't race on ovals anymore. The cars were too fast, and we couldn't slow them down. We were running out of tools to slow them down with. So that's going to be an interesting challenge.
Got a question here from Buddy Campbell. He said, in a previous episode with your technical director, Eric Bretzman, he mentioned that the current IndyCar couldn't go much faster without a brake package redesign, and this was Eric and I discussing that next generation engine and such. He said, didn't the Panos DP01 go faster down the straight than the current car? He said, was the DP01 designed from the get-go to brake that fast, and the DW12 wasn't? And he also said, side note, I'm not sure of your Indy Lights timeline, but were you at Savannah in 97 for the Dixie Crystals Grand Prix? I was not, Buddy. I graduated from Indy Lights at the end of 96 with Genoa Racing, and 97 is when we started our little Indy Racing League adventure. So we did still have an Indy Lights team, though. I believe Oz Negri was driving for us that year. And yeah, I forget where we were packing up and getting ready to go, but I do remember the lights team heading off to Savannah, and I think we might have been headed to the speedway. I'm not sure. On the brake side, keep in mind that with the DP01's brake package, unless I'm completely failing memory wise, I believe those were steel brakes, and the brake zones were just longer. With what we have now, or what we had with Brembo, and what we even have today with the Performance Friction Corporation Buddy, those are designed specifically for this existing chassis package. So for what Eric was mentioning is, you know, we don't have discs and pads, for example, that are giant that could easily handle an extra, pick whatever the number is, 20 miles an hour into a braking zone, or just tons more energy to control and shed. We're, you know, not too far away from their limit with what we have right now. So with whatever we end up, both with an engine sending cars down the straights faster with more speed to shed, or weight differences, whatever might be coming in the future, just know that a new brake package would be required to handle whatever those projected speeds and forces might be. Gabe Argenta.
But it's all solvable. It's all out.
Oh,
there.
Yeah. I mean, this.
Yeah, back in the day, we had metal matrix calipers and things. You can fix a lot of things with more money. You know, we put some, it's just a cost benefits analysis, really, right? You put more expensive materials into the brake system and they'll perform better, but they'll cost a lot more money. So I think that's the point, right, is to go faster, we're going to have to upgrade a lot of things on the car, including the brakes, and there's a cost to all those things. So you have to plan for it, all of it.
But certainly achievable. So we're not, I mean, wouldn't be heading into any unknown territories, but yeah, you don't want to make things hideously expensive as well. So I think that's, IndyCar could come up with a spec for the next generation chassis tomorrow. But the real question and the things that take time is to figure out how do we do that without things costing so much? What's the smartest way to do that? So that's why, you know, it will take time for them to come up with exactly what they project for speeds, and then also what is needed to either make a car accelerate or stop or turn. And so again, from tires to brakes to transmission to, I mean, pick all the systems involved, getting to what they want, that's not the hard part. Getting there in a manner that isn't, you know, cost prohibitive and too crazy while still delivering that performance, you know, that's where the real skill is involved. And, you know, also we can't just say that this is solely the decision in terms of, you know, knowing all the options and the experience of IndyCar's technical department. That is reaching out to a Firestone, to a PFC, to a lot of those partners to say, hey, this is what we're thinking. What do you got? Is it even realistic to do performance-wise? What do you think it would cost if, you know, we asked you to produce X amount of so-and-so? So that's the boring part of this process, buddy. But it's also a really important part, because what you don't want to do is have a bunch of teams like Brian's go, hey, we love IndyCar, but this new idea you came up with, yeah, we can't afford it. So come up with something a little bit different, please. Let's see. Last couple questions. Gabe Argenta. He says, is there anything fans can do to help Indy Lights grow other than the obvious by attending races and talking about it on social media? Thanks, as always. Great question, Gabe. At least in the conversation that I had last week with Anders Krohn, he and I, you know, both cover Indy Lights and love it passionately. I know you do as well, as an former entrant, etc. You know, the only thing I keep hearing that can help Brian is pick the percentage, but a big percentage off the annual budget, 30%, 40%, who knows? Is there anything else you think that can be done on the fan side?
Costs are a big part. You know, cost, the price point's probably a little bit high, as you mentioned. I really see some of it, though, as the natural ebb and flow of a feeder series. You know, the reason that Indy Lights is in the position it is, number one, it's graduated a lot of drivers recently up into the Indy cars, but it's also graduated some teams recently into Indy car. And, you know, Carlin, when they moved up, they didn't maintain their Indy Lights program because all the resource that it took to put two Indy cars on the track. Now, I think they'll probably come back in a year or two with an Indy Lights program again. When Junco's moved up, they kept an Indy Lights car, but they didn't keep a two or three car program as they'd had in the past. So it was as much a victim of their own success as anything else with Indy Lights in the last couple of years. But what's good and what I look at for the future is there's a big glut of drivers you see in USF 2000 right now. Last year you saw Pro Mazda was the really small class, right? So Pro Mazda is starting to refill the pipeline now. Indy Lights is feeling that glut from Pro Mazda and the teams moving up. As these USF 2000 kids move into Pro Mazda and the Pro Mazda kids move up, that pipeline will start to fill back up again. And what we need is a couple more teams to come in or call in to reinvigorate their Indy Lights program, and it will be strong again. But unfortunately, it's always going to be that way because it's a stepping stone as much as a destination for most people.
Yes, and that's a great point about, you know, the cycle of teams moving and such. I mean, it's easy to just say low car count, it's collapsing, it's bad. Not the case. But the price point, I think, is something that it's really becoming hard to ignore, that without a reduction, it will be a challenge to, I think, significantly grow the car count. But, you know, it's not as if these are issues that just popped up this year, nor is it something that the leadership at Anderson Promotions, even IndyCar, which is wanting to take a little bit more of an active role in seeing what they can do to help, if they can help. I know that, you know, the issues that Indy Lights is facing, they aren't a surprise, and they aren't being ignored. These things also don't rectify themselves overnight. So there's a little bit of, usually a little bit of a time portion of having to wait to see how things hopefully come to the good. Got a great question here, Brian, from Nick Fesco. And I like this because it's not necessarily aimed at your son, but as someone who has developed young talent. He says, at what point in a driver's development do you know if they have what it takes to make it to the top of, and he says, insert the top class of whatever it is. He said, to expand on that, lap time or funding aside, what helps you determine if a driver, you know, has that thing, that that hard, maybe hard to quantify thing where you go, ooh, this kid's playing with something special and could make it to the top?
Oh. the short answer is, you know, pretty quickly, really. You know, if somebody's really special, you tend to see that pretty early on, even when they're younger in karting. You know, a lot of drivers in Europe are in the road to Indy that, you know, are currently competing, or even in the IMSA series. You know, our kids that I watched at the go-kart track when I was there with my son competing, and in most cases, I would say there's not a lot of surprises in who's, you know, who's been able to move on and move up and start careers. You know, there's a lot. It crushes me because I used to hear it a lot at the go-kart track, is parents telling their kids, oh, we don't have a lot of money, you're never going to make it, because that's the only way. And that's patently untrue. To me, that's a cop-out, an excuse. It's really, really hard. And there's a lot of sacrifices, and you got to find money. But, you know, I look at a kid like Parker Thompson.
Oh, yeah.
Doing a great job leading Pro Mazda. And he, you know, I mean, he and Colton used to bang wheels on a weekly basis in go-karts, you know, and I know how good he is. And I know that, you know, his family has done what they can to support him, but they can't fund his racing career and just say, okay, here's a check, go racing with it. So, you know, I look at those guys and I always try and tell young drivers and families, it's not about you have to have all the money in the world. It's hard, and there's no guarantee. And even if you have all the talent in the world, you might not make it in this sport. But if you have a lot of talent, people recognize, and people tend to try and rally around that and try and help and create opportunities. And, you know, I believe that. And I think you do see those flashes in the young guys. You know, maybe the guy is going off the track a lot, but he's showing speed, and he's got a couple of good qualifyings, and he's made a couple of exciting passes, and those are the flashes you look for initially, and then they start putting all the stuff together, and it's a little bit of a path to get to where you can win races and then compete for championships. All those things, that's what experience buys you. But that raw kind of it thing, that's in there, and if you look really hard, you can usually spot it pretty quickly, pretty early on.
It's a great point you raise, and I've spent, as I've told folks, I spent more of my career working below IndyCar than I did in IndyCar. I mean, I worked in IndyCar for 5 years straight, but before that for 10-plus years, whatever, was in some form of what we would call the Mazda Road to Indy today, and even afterwards continue to work, you know, in Pro Mazda and other stuff on the weekends, engineering or whatever, and it's a great point you raise. That it thing, it's really hard to identify. And, you know, to the primary question here from Nick, you know, if you're talking about basketball, well, if you see this kid is just dunking all over everyone for the entire game or just draining three-pointers from anywhere, that's a pretty clear indicator this kid has some crazy talent you can build upon. But in racing, you know, lap time's a great thing. But I'll tell you, and to Brian's point, I can't think of a single IndyCar star or sports car star or anyone, you know, race winner, championship winner, where I've looked at them and said, I can't find that it factor in you. It's there. It's just there. I really cannot think of any examples where you go, man, I don't know how that guy got to where he is, because he looks, there's just nothing really that stands out. And even at the younger age, like you mentioned, Parker Thompson, Oliver Askew's another one, where, you know, Victor Franzoni, and we can name so many others where you look at him and go, this kid's got something. I don't know if he or she is going to be able to get all the way to the top, but how they speak, that look in their eye, how they carry themselves, there's just something that stands out as unique. And you can often do that, as you well know, Brian, without knowing anything about the kid. You know, you meet him for the first time and you might not know their history, but you go, I'm going to go look that kid up, because I bet there's some good results there supporting who they are. But I do love the fact that you might not always be able to define what it is, but the truly, truly good ones seem to have it, whatever it is. All right, let's jump to the last couple of questions here. One from Dean Ackerman says, Brian, have you or Colton found proper victory tacos in locations like Iowa? He says, the corn shells should probably be quite fresh in that Hawkeye state, though. I guess that is a good question. Do you have like a little list? Like, oh, we're going here this weekend. This is the spot to keep in the back of your mind.
So for those that don't know the Victory Tacos story, it was something that we started when Colt was a kid racing go-karts. And there was a really great tacos shop right on the way home from our local kart track. And so whenever he won, we'd stop there and celebrate with Victory Tacos. And then as, you know, he started racing more spread out, and then I started my own team, we kind of carried that tradition on. And even now, so when we win or one of our teams wins, we try to celebrate with Victory Tacos. But we don't have a list. That's the point. It's got to be spontaneous.
See, and, I like that.
You know, and you just know, you know, this is a Victory Taco. We earned this one with a win, so that makes it even better.
Let's see. Jeremy Ghosh says, when all is said and done, who will have had a more successful career, Brian or Colton Herta?
Hopefully him. Hopefully him. I wish that for him. I wish him all the success in the world, as any parent would.
Oh, I thought you were going to say, go to hell, kid. Earn it. Earn it or nothing. But until then, I'm not saying a darn thing. Let's see. Josette Torres asks a question, and I have to admit, I don't know what this is pertaining to, so I'm hoping you do. Potato salad. What's the deal? Is there a potato salad angle here I've missed in the Herta family?
On my Twitter account, I used to say, my description used to say, I like racing, and then I added, and potato salad, because Marco and I got in a debate last year whether I could go an entire day eating nothing but potato salad, which I really like. I'm a bit of a potato salad connoisseur.
That's something you and I share. I didn't even know that, but yes.
I'm not a big fan of the German potato salad, but all other types of potato salad I like. And so... I said I could eat nothing but potato salad for all day. He goes, no, you couldn't. So I tried, and it turns out, no, you cannot eat only potato salad for an entire day. But it, anybody who's curious, you should give it a shot. And if somebody pulls it off, let me know. I couldn't do it. And I love potato salad, so that's the potato salad story.
And granted, my body shape would suggest I'm a fan of potato salad. You not so much, but yeah, I'm not a big fan of the heavy egg, almost yellow tinted potato salad. I don't know, it's not German. I don't know how to describe it, but just call it more traditional mayonnaise based potato salad with maybe some onions or scallion, whatever, something in there, but nothing too complex. The best I might have ever had, though, was Japanese potato salad, which is more of a whipped kind of thing. Wow.
I've never had that.
Yeah, that might be on the old bucket list there to add that one. We're not talking victory.
I feel like we should have a potato salad taste-off now. I'm going to have to go down and see if we have any in the fridge when we finish. Now you're making me hang.
I think Marshall Pruitt podcast live event, we'll do it in an IndyCar race. Maybe we need to have a bring your favorite potato salad portion of the event and make sure that you are on for that one. Let's see, a couple more here. Travis Bender, I think you might have sent this to me on Facebook privately in a DM, and it feels like I've gotten this about three or four times, so I apologize if I haven't gotten to this one before. He says, it seems like there is a fair amount of hype from people about Max Chilton, and thus far, there hasn't been much to back it up. What gives? Do guys like he and Kimble and others with few results have a future in IndyCar? Do results talk? Or is it just about sponsored dollars? A lot of little things to unpack there, Travis. And since he's a since his team is a rival of yours, Brian, I wouldn't ask you to comment. Max was pretty forthright from the beginning of when he got to IndyCar, Travis, in saying his third year in whatever championship he's been in has always been his best. So we're in his third season right now. I think if you look back to year two with Chip Ganassi, when he was with Chip Ganassi Racing, I don't want to say that he was on pace to be, you know, a breakout star or anything like that, but I can say that I recall more quality drives in his second season of IndyCar than his first. He finished 11th in the championship, which, knowing how deep the IndyCar championship is, you know, that to me was not, it wasn't something to ignore, right? I mean, granted, when you have Scott Dixon as a teammate, Tony Kanaan, and Charlie Kimble, and you look at the fact that, again, at least last year, in his second year, Dixie was third in the championship, Kanaan was 10th, not that far ahead of Chilton, and Charlie just had a not particularly pleasant year altogether. I'd say we came out of, or I came out of 17, feeling positive that Max was headed in the right direction. The only issue here since then, and I know Brian can attest to this, is he didn't continue for a third year with Chip Ganassi Racing. Went to, you know, startup in Trevor Carlin's program, and no matter how good Carlin Racing is, it's a brand new team, and, you know, had Max's race engineer and all of that information followed him over to that team, maybe they would be a little bit more competitive week in, week out. But that thing about my third year's always my best, I'd say it would be really hard to say, ha ha, you're wrong, you know, that was false, because he's essentially starting from scratch in his third season with a new team. And, you know, I will say, because it is, you know, if you just look at the numbers, you can definitely say that at least with himself and Charlie Kimble in the team, both now ex-Ganassi drivers, it seems like Charlie is having the better year by not a small margin, by, you know, an appreciable margin. But then you look at the results and you go, well, Chuck is 17th in the standings with three top 10s, granted, a 10th, an 8th, and a 10th, and Max is 20th, no top 10s, but not, you know, points-wise, Max is 134 points, Chuck is at 151. So I know we might not look at Charlie and say there is a future IndyCar champion, but the guy has won a race, is impressive, you know, at a decent number of races per year. I'd say the biggest surprise for me, at least at this stage, Travis, is I thought that Max might be closer to Charlie than he has been. So if anything, I don't know if it's hype, but I part of me wonders if Max is enjoying himself a lot right now. And maybe this is something you can share some insight on, Brian, to close on this topic. I've worked with a couple of drivers in the past who were, you know, their fathers were quadrillionaires. And it seems like there you'll get one of two sons of wealthy driver type profiles. You either get the F it, my life is awesome, I get to drive race cars, this is the best thing in the world, nothing's going to bother me, and they go out and do well. And then you get the others who are born of wealth and seem to carry some mental baggage and sometimes they struggle to have the mental clarity or to get out of their own way, something where there's this burden that they carry and struggle to tap into their full potential. Max strikes me a little bit of that latter scenario. Someone who, you know, clearly he has talent, but connecting with it on a consistent basis seems to be the struggle. Have you seen any examples like that, Brian, throughout your career with drivers, you know, who maybe come from a you know, lofty financial background, and but maybe don't have the easiest of time always demonstrating their talent?
I don't know. I mean, I guess I try and separate the on-track from the off-track circumstance because, you know, I think sometimes that can help you arrive at a situation, but, you know, how big your checkbook is does make zero difference once you put the helmet on and you have to go drive the race car, and you can either do it or you can't. So, I mean, I think there's been good examples of guys who've come from, you know, wealthy or poor backgrounds that have been pretty damn good race car drivers and vice versa. You know, and I think in Max and Charlie's case, you know, they've taken on a project this year with Carlin coming in and being new to IndyCar, and they took it on as a complete independent team. You know, and they've done it in a way that, you know, I think is difficult because you got a lot of really experienced teams that have multiple car programs, and so I think this year you have to kind of consider some of their results are just laden by the fact that they're with a team that's learning. You know, it's almost like their rookie season again, except it's the team that's a rookie and not the driver. But, you know, they've had some good results. I'm kind of rooting for them because I know Trevor Carlin well, and I've got a lot of respect for their program, and I think they've got a great future in IndyCar. And I know it's challenging for any driver to be going through those kind of growing pains with the team, but I think both Charlie and Max have kind of talked about they knew when they were signing up that was going to be part of what they were going through in the first year, and I don't think that they've done anything but a good job in helping that process along, and I think Carlin has done a really good job. They've acquitted themselves well, and I think they'll continue to get better.
Yeah, and Trevor's team is so important to IndyCar in representing that you can come in, you can be successful, and no one expected that to happen right away. I think, you know, as they look to the future, will they add more veteran IndyCar engineers and those with, you know, very specific IndyCar type bits of experience on the timing stand? I think that is one area that they've recognized they need a little bit more of. But, you know, again, it's not as if there's a playbook that when you said, hey, Brian Herta Autosports going to be an IndyCar team, could you please send me the big book on how to do everything perfectly? There are some things you got to figure out on your own, and some things I'm sure that you tried philosophy or practice-wise where you said, all right, I think this is going to be the way. And after 6 months or a year, you said, all right, to hell with that. I'm going to go in a different direction because I've learned that maybe that, you know, what I thought might be the trick isn't the trick. So, you know, the point is there's no way to learn about how to be an IndyCar team other than to start being an IndyCar team. So these kinds of things that Trevor's team is learning, they've proven that once they get things figured out, they are beasts. So that's what I look forward to. All right, one more question from Twitter, then a final one from Facebook, and we're going to say farewell to this episode, my friend. Simon Spikert says, hey, in CART's heyday, there were big sponsors and manufacturer cash. It flowed freely. He says, can you share a story of, you know, that one story at least from the excess of those days that young racers and current fans might not believe? So not necessarily about out of your own pocket, but there were sponsors that spent a lot of money. There were drivers who had some pretty big retainers. Any stories come to mind on how good we had it in the 90s?
Yeah, you know, I mean, even then I remember, you know, like, money flowed freely compared to now, maybe, but you were always striving for more and trying to raise more. And, you know, people, you know, when people ask me how much does it cost to win an IndyCar, you know, I always give them the same answer. It's all of it. You know, whatever you can get is what it takes. And if you can raise more, then it takes that too. But yeah, back in that day, you know, budgets and 12, and you know, you were hearing talk of teams with $10 to $12 million per car budgets. I think maybe one of the funny, cool things that we did one time when we started racing down at Homestead is I was driving for Bobby Rahal. He had a membership down the Ocean Reef Club down there, down in the Keys. It was a bit of a drive, so he chartered a helicopter, and we stayed down there and took a helicopter every day back and forth to the track, which I thought was really kind of boss, but it's something that it was really neat, but not something I think you would see in current times.
Well, maybe we can afford like 4 mini drones and get some straps and, you know, pick you up that way and fly you around. That would be kind of fun. Or maybe completely...
maybe. Or not. Or maybe I'll just take my rental car and go.
Yes, that might be the safer option. All right, last question. And I hope this is all true, because if not, I chose the wrong final question. This one comes in from Jordan Darwin, who's kind enough to send in multiple questions on regular occasion. Because I read that Brian was going to drive a Ford-powered Lola or Renard for Dan Gurney's All-American Racers in 2000. Brian, how close was that deal to becoming a reality? And any good Dan Gurney stories? He says, I've always maintained that the year 2000 was star-crossed year for you, and as a Shell brat, I always liked cheering for you.
Oh, that's nice. And yeah, it got pretty darn close. You know, I went down to the All-American Racers team several times, met with Dan, and I mean, what a thrill. I'd known him, but I really got to know him during that period when we were trying to put the deal together. And you know, you just can't say enough great things about Dan Gurney and the gentleman he was. And you know, he'd take me to lunch at the local sports pub right around the corner from All American Racers. I remember he had a minivan.
Yep.
Dan Gurney drove a minivan, and he used to lay the seat back like really far, like almost like you would in a Formula car. And that was kind of how he drove on the street. And I always thought that was kind of really unique and interesting. But I so wished that there was a way that could have happened, because you know, driving for Dan, I can't imagine what could have been any more enjoyable or more of a privilege for a driver.
Amen. We're coming up on about 6 months. We're not too far away from 6 months since we lost the Big Eagle, and not to be melodramatic, but rarely a day goes by where I don't think of him in some way, shape, or form, and it's just strange not having the comfort in the knowledge that the Big Eagle was there in Southern California to keep us straight or to provide sanity whenever something silly might have cropped up in motor racing. So, glad you guys got to know each other then. It would have been awesome, though, to have had an All-American Racers entry on your CV for your driving career, but nonetheless... Awesome. Well, Mr. Herta, thank you as always for joining us. And, you know, as I tell you on a regular basis, myself and Robin, and again, I know you mentioned our pal David Malsher and others, we look to you quite often to be that guy in the current paddock offering sanity or some wisdom that we can trust. So thanks again for taking time to speak to my listeners in our latest episode of The Week in IndyCar.
It's my great pleasure, Marshall, and really appreciate what you do to continue to spread the word for the sport we love. Thank you.